Kia ora, I'm Anke Richter, the founder of Decode, a groundbreaking cult awareness conference happening again this October in Aotearoa, New Zealand. We're going to have 2 days of powerful conversations about healing and justice with survivors, experts, lawyers, therapists, and authors. And we're live streaming them around the world. Decult will make a huge difference for people who've come out of cults. Join us from 24th to 25th of October in Christchurch or online for Decult 2026 Voices of Courage. Go to decult.net to register now.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have a returning guest, a colleague and friend, Chris Shelton. He is a former Scientologist and Sea Org member and is now a writer, a consultant, a podcaster, a YouTuber, and an advocate for critical thinking. He was born and raised in California, and he also grew up in a Scientology household, and he learned about its principles at a very young age. He is someone who has become so important in this field and wants people to understand not only how this happens, but why it happens and how to break free from it. And he has a new book he's going to be talking about called What Now? A Practical Guide to Life After a Cult, where he also talks about his REM model, which we will get into, REM model of behavior. So here is our conversation. It is a total pleasure to have Chris Shelton back on the show. You guys know him. You love him. He's been on before. He has so much to talk about. He's always so busy doing so many things. And he has been studying and doing this whole program, a school program, and writing, and has this new book out, this new book that is titled What Now? I love that. And because it is. There it is. And it is so important to know what can happen next or what should happen next or why it's difficult for certain things to happen next and how to approach it. And also the sort of pinnacle of his work at the moment, because I'm sure there will be others, is this REM model of behavior that we are going to dive into. But definitely buy the book so that you get to read more about it and explore it more, because we're just going to, even I know we're going to talk for over an hour, but I'm sure we're still going to just scratch the surface. So welcome back to the show, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you for your kind and generous words. I really appreciate that. Always fun to chat with you.
Always really, really nice. So, okay, let's talk. So you've been a busy bee doing a lot of work, and tell us also about the studies that you did and your degree and then moving into being able to do this work also with that new information kind of woven in to your own personal experience.
Grew up in a cult, and so Scientology was really, really bad stuff. And I got out of that about 13 years ago, escaped in 2013. And so I've had the very lucky and fortunate circumstance of being able to do full-time work to kind of recover from Scientology, figure out what the hell happened to me. And in the process of doing that through a YouTube channel and through the work that I've in my writing and working with others, I've been able to very fortunately been able to help other people as well in a non-therapeutic role. Because I'm not a therapist, but I do love helping people and consulting with people. And so through that work and through my own recovery process, I've been able to learn an awful lot of stuff. And I get to do it full time, which is awesome, right? So I get a lot of exposure to this information. And so I've gotten to talk to psychologists and sociologists and neuroscientists and therapists and ex-members from all different groups. And And over all these years, the only reason I say all that is because it's really given me this really knowledge base beyond just me and my own experience for what is it that happens to people after they come out of a coercive situation, right? And the therapy role is vital, vital, vital. But there's, and I should say not but, because there is really no but to that. It's just also, and there is an education component too. And I just can't get past that. And I can't stress it or underline it or boldface it enough. And so for me, that the big milestone education for my own recovery was doing the Psychology of Coercive Control program at Salford University. And it was this, you know, year and a half long program for me, full time of learning all about the frameworks and domains and structures of coercive control and how it works. And that was the second hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life. There was this particular aspect of Scientology that was 3 years of prison labor, hard labor. That was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. That university doesn't compare to that, because that was just hard physical labor. But this was a real program to get through. Rod and Linda Dubrow Marshall really put together a real championship program on what is this thing that people do to each other, this repeating pattern of abusive behavior. And so that really informed an awful lot of my work and my study and my discussions with people, because I think, as you know, you were one of the very first people who actually suggested to me or gave me the idea many, many, many years ago that there is such a thing as a cult of one, that you can be in this abusive relationship, and that, you know, before I even really had my wits around coercive control, just that alone introduced the idea that it is about the relationship dynamics. It's not about a bad egg or a bad actor, you know, who has a bad day and treats you badly. It's a repeating pattern of a behavior that predatory personalities are naturally, organically engaging in. They don't have to learn or study or think about it. It's just what they do. And this is what we call coercive control. So I say all of that stuff to say that that's kind of the foundation for what I put together in this book. Is I kind of went, okay, so it's been, you know, I got to this point in my own recovery and my own therapy and my own education where I thought, you know, I'm not really suffering anymore from Scientology. It's been like 10 years. I'm not dreaming about it. I don't think with it. It's not like I talk about it all the time, but it doesn't consume my attention. I'm not obsessed with it. And I no longer feel like, when I look at Scientology as an ex-member now, I feel more like a non-member than an ex-member, because there's so much distance from it and from all of the ideas and the deconstruction of it sort of, you know, pulls it out bit by bit, piece by piece. And so I kind of hit this place where I thought, wow, I'm kind of feel like I'm a little recovered from this, you know, and not as a status thing, because, you know, just as a thing, just kind of, oh, I think I can acknowledge that there's been progress in this journey. You know, it's kind of that kind of thing. And I thought, well, what are all these lessons? What's gotten me here? What is it that helps people arrive to a place where they can have some peace of mind about their very traumatizing experience? And I think, as a second gen, you know, as somebody who grew up in it, I think that there's an even deeper level of indoctrination or identity manipulation, you could say, that happens in these groups, because when we're raised with it, it's, you know, it's your normal from day one. There is no questioning this. There's no coming out of it and going to your pre-cult personality. What's that when you got involved when you were three, you know? So I had to kind of, you know, so reworking kind of that whole model of recovery too, which is a great model for people who get recruited as adults. But for kids, it's of cults, it's a little bit of a deeper, different thing. Not more difficult necessarily. It's not a matter of comparison that way. It's just a matter of it being a little bit different, you know? So I wanted to address that. And I wanted to address trauma, and I wanted to address, you know, emotions and of course, critical thinking, because I glommed onto that early on. And that's kind of what I put together into this book. And there's my really long answer to your question. I feel like I'm going on and on and on here, but this has really been my life's work. And so where my first book about Scientology, A to Xenu, was really just kind of a breakdown of Scientology. It's kind of like, okay, well, here's what this thing is. And it was really cathartic to write that book. This is more of, okay, well, here's coercion and here's the after effects of it. And here are some things that had somebody, these are all the things I wish somebody had told me on day one. That's what this book is, right? It's not a 12-step program. It's not a guide to, you know, you read the book and suddenly you're recovered. It's really more of, here's the tool set I used. I think it would be helpful for everybody. Here you go. You know, that's kind of what I'm trying to do.
That's so nice. I mean, it's like a gift that you're giving to the people who need it, who can also get the book, even if it wasn't their experience, but if they know others who could benefit from it. Like, it's a good book to give someone for a birthday. Like, here, you get to kind of start your life anew, you know, and here are the possibilities for you. And here are the ways to go about it. Because that's the hardest part, I think, that people are told what their goals can be, or they decide what they'd like their goals to be, but they don't at all know how to get there, nor do they trust themselves that they'll be able to do it, or that they trust that even the goal they set is the right one, because you've been so, you know, taught that you can't make these decisions for yourself and you'll make bad ones. It's reminding me, actually, as we're talking, of one of the times that we talked actually about the RPF that you were alluding to before, that happens in Scientology, the gulag of Scientology. And that you used this phrase that a lot of people responded to when they wrote in about the episode with you, that you learn to gaslight yourself. That was incredible, because it opened up this thought that here someone is working to gaslight you, but the part of the gaslighting is you're supposed to be doing it for yourself because you're taught this is for your benefit. And that is just horrible. Like, here, defame yourself, berate yourself for your benefit. Think that you're not capable of anything for your benefit. And it's just not the case. And it's a cruel thing that people don't realize they're having this sort of implanted. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about that just as you move forward, as you leave something and you move forward, you're having to fight against how you are still holding on to the programming. Because I hear people in my office say, I'm not really, you know, very smart, or I'm just not capable of making decisions. Like, these global statements of like,
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I think I knew where that came from. Right. And I'll say, like, based on what? And they don't really even know. It's just that it was repeated so often that they then think this is fact about themselves. And it's really, it can be devastating to the psyche, but also any level of self-confidence.
Oh, it's so much so. And I think that gaslighting component, yeah, it's a real interesting inversion that happens in these groups, because you become convinced, see, in a normal world, like in the movie Gaslighting, going all the way back to the origin story of that term, right? This is a woman whose husband was engaging in this repeating pattern of trying to make her go crazy by altering things in the house and moving things around and lying to her constantly about things. And she's resisting it the whole time. But the thing about a cult, and she's fighting it and wondering and pushing back and wondering and constantly in this state. But in a cult, they lull you into a different place where this is a safe environment. This is a community. These are the people you can trust more than anybody else in the whole world. And you buy into this. That's why you join and sign up and get pulled in. And so the gaslighting that's happening, the lying and the double binds and the manipulation are something that are given to you with such a friendly face. And it's all for your own good. And this is what you need. And if it's a little disciplinary or it's a little harsh, well, you can't, you know, the whole, you can't, you know, sacrifice is necessary, right? You can't make an omelet with broth break and some eggs. So you buy into that. And it's that little slow boil, right, of the frog in the water, right? It's that slow thing where you, that inversion happens, where you suddenly are now rationalizing or coming up with all your own reasons why this abuse or this weirdness or this strangeness or these red flags that you do see, but you kind of, maybe you negate them. Well, I don't know. And it's only in hindsight we look back and go, oh my God, I saw it, but I didn't do anything about it. Or I thought this other thing about it. Well, that's completely natural. It doesn't mean you're broken if you're doing that. We all do that. This is how we navigate life. But when it's in an abusive environment, we always kick ourselves later, you know, and then those phrases come out, that I'm stupid, I'm an idiot, I'm not this, I'm that. Those are the things they tell you and condition you into so that you'll stay. And you'll feel powerless against their power, and you want that power, so you stay, because eventually you're not going to be the stupid person, the idiot, the overthinker, the, you know, the introvert, the whatever the thing is you're trying to resolve about yourself in that group. You think eventually you're going to graduate out of that, but the whole environment is designed to keep you powerless and keep you in that condition. It's not designed to help you. So I think that whole environmental control is really what people don't see. And so because they don't see it's happening to them, they end up, well, I'm sure you've seen plenty of examples of this where they introvert and go, no, it's on me. It's my fault. This was me. This wasn't a them problem. This was a me problem. And of course, this has always helped. I have yet to see, tell me if you've seen an exception to this. I have yet to see a single group that hasn't messed with the concept of responsibility.
That's interesting. That has been universal. I have never heard of people saying, yeah, no, it's cool because, you know, I was able to just like, I knew I was really clear about who was responsible and who wasn't and who the culprit was and who the perpetrator was and who the victim was. No, it is never clear. And it is never someone else.
That's right.
Wow.
Right. That's always the guy in the mirror.
Right.
Who's responsible for everything, right? And it's always that way in these groups. It's almost characteristic. You know, you could almost put it on the checklist, right? And it's just really, really wild to watch how they do it. But they always do this undermining of your own determinism, right? You're never capable. You're never able enough or powerful enough. And yet at the same time, you're the one who's doing every single bad thing that's ever happening to you, or pulling it in, as they say in Scientology.
Right, pulling it in. Right, exactly. So I also want to talk about this term unearned guilt, because it's another one that's like you have these, when you write, I've noticed, or when you speak of these little tasty morsels. And so I want to go to that idea before we, you know, dive into this REM. There is so much that people deal with similar to what we're talking about the sense of responsibility, that somehow you're doing things on purpose or that you meant to do that. And you're not believed if you say, no, that wasn't my fault. But you get to the point where you think, well, maybe it was. Maybe I did do this on purpose. And maybe I was being cruel. Maybe I was being selfish by, you know, sleeping in because I was sick. You know, whatever it is, right? It's just a heinous crime of self-care.
That's right. You cared for your health. What's wrong with you?
That's right. Exactly, right? You're going to do in the whole universe by, right, sleeping another hour. That's just a tiny bit of pressure. So let's talk about this unearned guilt and how that also played out in your story and what you do with that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Guilt was a big, big, big thing for me. And I'm glad in a way, now that I'm sitting where I'm sitting, having this wonderful conversation with you, I'm glad that it was Scientology, because in a way I got the worst of it in a lot of ways. And this is not, again, a competition between cults, but I think it's kind of acknowledged between you know, cult experts that I've spoken with over the years that Scientology is certainly one of the more, if not the most, complex series of control mechanisms that are put together. There's just years and years of Hubbard adding to this thing, and guilt induction is a primary, really, really basic tool in Hubbard's toolkit that he used over and over and over again. And it was not just the fact of it, it was the fact of how many ways it was coming at you, you know, through different language and different mechanisms that Hubbard would invent that supposedly exist in your mind. And I'll give you an example. A very core concept in Scientology is something that's a little hard to fully easily explain fully, but I think the core idea is pretty easy to get. It's called a service facsimile. And this is a concept of an internal mechanism or desire or need that everybody has that is the overwhelming demand or desire to be right and to make other people wrong. You're right because they're wrong. And part of the package of a service facsimile is not only just being right about stuff, but it's adjacent to or tied in with disabilities. And so if you have bad eyesight or you feel sick one day or you have an upset stomach or something, you could tie that to some kind of right-wrong thing. And like, for example, I don't want to go to school and the kid is faking being sick and the mom goes, no, you have to go to school. And the kid's, you know, but I'm sick. I thought if I was sick, I didn't have to go to school. I thought that was the rule. And the mom's like, no, I know you're faking it. So you're going to school. And the kid's like, no, I'm not faking it. I'm not faking it. And the mom's like, no, I know you are. And you're going to school. And so there's this right-wrong thing happening. And so the service facsimile, Hubbard says, and this is a completely invented thing. This isn't real. I'm just saying in Scientology, they say this is real. The service fact comes in and it actually makes you sick. So now you actually have a disability because you're making your mom wrong because you have to be right. And you can become so right that you can pull in bad eyesight, chronic pains, chronic disorders, problems, issues. This is the solution, Scientology. This is the answer, Scientology says, for what ails you. This is why you have these chronic disabilities and problems, is because of your service facsimiles. And this is what we need to deal with. And so guess who's responsible for every single bad thing that's happening to you? You are. Yeah, dork, right? All the any kind of abuse that came your way, any kind of manipulation that came your way, any kind of external, you know, sources of threat or punishment or whatever else. Not in that case with the sick kid, but other examples of where people could be, you know, abused or coerced, and then they suffer disabilities as a result or suffer problems or issues as a result. Scientology will eventually ultimately tell you, well, you pulled that in. That was on you. See, it wasn't your abuser who was the problem. It was you. And that's that whole, and that's where the guilt just goes, the meter just goes, it goes to infinity. There is no end to what you're guilty of, right? Every single bad thing. And that's just one mechanism in Scientology. The service facsimile is a really important concept in Scientology, but it's one of about 100 such mechanisms of guilt induction. So it's a wild topic, right? And that's why I say I'm glad that it was Scientology for me, because I got to, in deconstructing it all and comparing and contrasting notes with other cults, JWs, Mormons, you know, Moonies, NXIVM members, anything and everything that I've compared and contrasted Scientology to, there's always been some comparison. There's always been some, oh yeah, we did that too, you know? And it was interesting because not everybody does what's in Scientology, but Scientology is doing what everybody else is doing. Anyway, in terms of the Venn diagram of it, you know, it really is the cult of cults. So I say all that only because it was really nice to be able to deconstruct it. And in the process of doing so, see these same mechanisms in other groups too and go, oh, yes, I see how this works for them. also, maybe they don't have a service facsimile, but they're using God or biblical scripture or, you know, rules around, you know, biblical scripture that some guy invents, like Bill Gothard and his umbrella of protection against the darts of Satan. You know, I'm not making fun of people's faith, but Bill Gothard takes it to, you know, a level of child abuse. So I get to make fun of him and his umbrella of protection, right? So, you know, you get these mechanisms that these guys come up with that are really designed to make people feel powerless and weak and ineffective against whatever the enemy is that's being set up by the cult. And that's why they need to stay in the cult, because they can never get to a position that the cult leader's in where they have power and dominion over these disabilities or problems or issues. They're always stuck with them, and it's always their fault. And I think that's key to the cult experience.
Absolutely key. And it ties into how it is this, like, they tie it up with a bow. It's kind of amazing, because then what gets woven into it that keeps it going is also that you're not supposed to question, but also the whole idea of false correlation. So if you do get sick, could be from the stress, could be from the pressure, but they'll say it's because of what you did that pulled it in. And so that's something that's really hard to abandon also once you leave, because you're going to be making connections between things that aren't connected, but things that kind of underscore the gaslighting.
That's right. Exactly. It's all the confirmation bias we run on ourselves, right? That idea that, well, this thing must be true, so I'm going to find all the facts that support it, and I'm going to carefully ignore everything that doesn't. And we're trained to do that. We're not just like falling into this or having a moment of silly stupidity. We are trained to accept these ideas over and over and over again in ways that a lot of us, you know, you don't even see it when it's happening. Sometimes it's so subtle. It's signage. It's even emotional manipulation. It doesn't even always involve words. That they connect these things to feelings and attitudes and stuff, right? Here's one of the things I always seem to find true in this. Maybe it's not always true, but it seems to be that it's always about simple answers to complex problems, which are easy to hold on to. So you want to hold on to them because I got the answer, right? Here's this really big, complex world problem or personal issue problem or relationship problem. And you can't think your way through it because there's all these layers and levels to it. And it's so complicated. And then cult leader goes, yeah, but look, it's just this right here. It's all you got to do is think about blue and everything's going to be fine. And you're like, oh, blue, good. I'll just think blue. And it's a simple solution. And sometimes it's emotionally satisfying. And most of the time it's not, but you know, it needs to be true. So we need to make it true. So we do.
It needs to be true. Yeah, that is a great phrase. It's so true. So, right. So moving on to this REM, this model, I love it. And I love that it also, it weaves in morality, which is so important, which is not talked about enough. Also, REM is one of my favorite bands, and I just love them. And I happen to be listening to one of the songs that I have on my playlist of REM, for many of them. But it's a song called Can't Get There From Here. And I thought, that is perfect. This is this perfect model. Like, you just can't get there. Wherever there is, it's being promised. You just can't get it from here, from this system that you're in, that you're trapped in. You know, you're not going to get there. And so I know it doesn't have anything to do with REM, the music, or rapid eye movement, but it is, it's a great acronym. And so let's get into it. So tell me, and it's super exciting, right, that you have this. And also when it comes together and it fits and you're like, yes, this is a thing. It's awesome when that happens. So I'm so excited for you. So let's talk about it. Go for it.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Here we go. So this is my own invention, but it's based on a bunch of very, very validated social science. This is not me going off and doing, you know, years of research. It's really me more compiling a model of existing science and information. to try to give a simple answer to a complex problem, right? Why do we act the way we do? Because it's a question that drove me for a real long time. It still does. It was, you know, what happened to me in the cult? And then from there, it was sort of, well, wait a minute, why are people acting the way they're acting anyway? And we have all these great models. There's probably about 20 of them that we covered on the Coercive Control Program for laying out what coercion is or how cults work, how domestic violence works. You have lots of different, you know, you have your Duluth model and you have your Bite model. You have a bounded choice model for, you know, in the cult sphere, you've got many, many, many different ones. And models are great. And to be clear, a model was really just a template to understand reality. It's not reality itself. It's just a map, right? So it may or may not always fit over the landscape of what you're looking at. Maybe the model applies, maybe it doesn't. But this one, I think when we look at something like a Bite model or a bounded choice model from Dr. Jan Jawalich, we see pretty universal models. It's a generalized statement of how to think about what happened to you in the cult. But my model, the REM model, is more the model of you. It's more the model of the person and the mental map. It's a model of what's going on in your head or in your body, in your mind. Because I think they're all the same thing. I don't have this like dual system where we're something separate from our body, right? So what is it that compels or motivates or drives us to do what we do? And that's what REM answers. And the way it works is that it's a layered thing. And at the bottom of the whole thing is you, the core consciousness that is you. And that you exists way deep, deep down in the lizard brain, maybe. I don't know where it exists. This isn't a physical model. But the idea of consciousness is something that's still being very, very deeply explored in science. It's a fascinating topic. I don't have to resolve the problem of consciousness to say we're conscious. And, right? So that's what I'm saying, that at the bottom of it is the conscious you. And on top of that comes the layers of morality and emotion and rationality. That's the REM, right? And it builds. So the closest thing, the most powerful set of factors, beliefs, ideas, structures, mental models that you have that drive behavior is your moral layer. And that sits right on top of the conscious layer, right? So you have consciousness, which is not about morals or emotions. It's just about existence. And right on top of that is morality. And morality is I know it's a little bit of a loaded word for some people, especially coming out of religion. I thought you were going to say the R.E.M. song, Losing My Religion.
yeah, that's funny. Right? Yes, we could talk about that too. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. But morality is, for me, in my model, I'm not going off into left field with it. It is what's right and wrong. It is a list of what's good and bad. It is your ought tos and shoulds and, you know, your rules and your manners and your etiquette and the codes of conduct. That all fits into what is morality. How do we get along with each other? How do we act? And morality is all about how we're supposed to act, how we learn to act in lots and lots of different circumstances. From the time we hit the playground, we are learning, oh, this is okay and this isn't. This is acceptable and this isn't. This is appropriate and this isn't. I can say this, I can't say this. Oh, but if I go around behind the barn with my friend, then I can say these other things, but I can't say it when the teachers are around, right? So you start learning beyond your parents, which you've been learning from day one. You know, you're learning these rights and wrongs and goods and bads and shoulds and ought tos. And it starts making a mental map of when I'm in this circumstance, this is how I act. And when I'm in this other circumstance, this is how I act. And what this gives you, though, over time, is not just a list of rules. It gives you a sense, a concept, you could say, of how the world is supposed to be. This is what it's supposed to look like. This is how people are supposed, because if I'm supposed to act this way, other people are supposed to act this way. This is an instant assumption we all make. And in fact, one of the biggest moral outrages we all have is hypocrisy. You say, but you don't do. What the hell? It's an automatic, ingrained default assumption that morality is for everybody. And we unfortunately make the unwarranted assumption that my morality is for everybody.
Right.
But everybody's got their own fingerprint on morality, their own, you know, their own layout of it based on their own experiences, their own education, even their own language. Language, you know, features into this. All of it sums up to this idea of our concept of how the world's supposed to look. And this is really, really important because the thing that we get morally outraged about or the things that we get really, really upset about are when our morals are violated. How dare you steal, kill, lie, cheat, steal? That feeling you get of, what? That's not supposed to be that way. That's right out of the moral air. That's exactly where that comes from. And you can, and that's why I say it's so basic to us. It's so fundamental. These are things you don't question. We don't have to sit around arguing or debating whether murder is right or wrong. We all know. You just know, right from the moral air, it's not right, period. And so you don't have to consult or modify or dig into this layer a lot. It's just there. And it kind of gives you a sense of how things are supposed to be. So that's a very, very basic layer of our interaction with the world and what compels us to act the way we do. And again, this is developmental stages. This is rule sets. This is codes of conduct. It does change and morph over time. None of this stuff is set in concrete. The moral layer is pretty hard, though. It's hard to get down that deep and mess around very easily. It takes a while to mess with that layer. Cults do, though. And so above that is the layer that we kind of live in a lot in our mental life and in our social life, and that's the emotional layer. And that sits right above the moral layer. So if you're looking at what's motivating behavior, what's driving you to do what you're doing, well, your emotions. And emotions are emotional reactions in the moment. I'm angry, I'm afraid, I'm happy, I'm sad. Those momentary, you're feeling it, but it's going to pass. Yeah. But then also, longer term, part of this layer is our emotional needs. And emotional needs, again, this is where it doesn't really matter to me which model of emotional needs you're using, because there's about four or five of them as far as breakdowns of what the different categories of our needs are. Different people have proposed different models of that. Doesn't really matter to me. All I care about is that you acknowledge you have emotional needs. And for a lot of people, that alone, it's a major epiphany. You know, what do you mean I have emotional needs? What? You know, they just don't even know. They don't think about it that way. But the emotional needs are really the engine that drives us. The morality is sort of the rails on the road, but the motor, the thing really going that is pushing us and compelling us to do stuff, is our effort to fulfill our emotional needs in life. Love, community, identity, meaning, purpose, justice. There's so many ways, there's so many categories or buckets that we're trying to fill. Right? What would a just world look like? I think a lot of people right now, that bucket's not very full, right? There's a lot of people going, justice, the injustices in the world. And people are compelled, motivated to spend their whole life, some people less than others. But some people, this is their life work, is they really focus on justice as an emotional need they have, and they work to fulfill it. And that's not that they're not working on their other emotional needs at the same time. We're always working on all of our emotional needs. We can't help it. This is how life is. So we need and the funny thing about emotional needs is we all have the same ones, basically, but how much we have to fill up each of those buckets is different from one person to the next. My need for community is not the same as your need for community. That's why you see some people terminally online all the time, desperately looking for community, where other people can put it aside. Yeah, I don't need that right now, right? And it's just not, they don't have that same need, or they don't have it to the same degree, or it's fulfilled in a different way, right? Because, of course, the other thing is that not everybody, you know, responds the same way to all the various ways that we can fill these buckets. For some people, you know, you're looking for community, but it has to be a particular kind of community. It can't just be anybody coming along and inviting you in. You know, it can't be the chocolate chip cookie company because you don't like chocolate chip cookies. So you're not going to join that group, right? But you're going to join this other group, and that's how you fulfill that need. The thing I'm saying is, until you do, there's this feeling inside you that something's not quite right. Something's not satisfied. And if people don't know about emotional needs, they will often struggle, sometimes for years, trying to even name what it is that's so unsatisfying. They can't get their finger on it. Everything seems fine. I got a job, I got a wife, I got a this, I got a that, but something's not right and I can't get my hand on what is it? And that search, that quest for meaning or purpose or identity or drive or whatever it is you're trying to fulfill motivates behavior, pushes us to do things, right? Pushes us to join a call, to join a group, to be part of this, be part of that. All kinds of things, right? Basically, what I'm saying is everything we do is driven by these desires to fulfill these needs or our desires to fulfill our emotional or our moral obligations and needs, because those are even more basic, right? And this is how I put morality below emotional needs, because when given a choice between right and wrong, even if it fulfills a need, we'll tend to go for what we think of as right rather than wrong. So the morals are always there guiding the decision-making. Is that, you know, it might be an emotionally needful thing for me to take all this money right now because I really need the satisfaction of having this money to go have this experience or something, but it's not right to do that. So I'm not going to do that, right? And so that's how they interact with one another. And then finally, on top of the layer of the emotions, which are not about words, by the way. Emotions are not about words. Emotions are feelings. They're states that your body experiences. So the words are all coming, the explanations and rationalizations and reasoning for why we feel these emotions, why our morality is important. All of that comes from the top layer, the third layer, the R, the reason rationalization layer. And the reason rationalization layer is the one that you're in touch with most of the time as a person, your inner monologue, the thoughts you're having, the words you tell yourself, the concepts you come up with to justify or reason out why you're doing what you're doing or why you want to do what you want to do. We all have desires. We all have these needs coming up. In the moment, needs can be coming from emotional reactions or longer-term emotional needs. They come from both places. When we get really angry, for example, we suddenly, you know, like our body is compelled to want to, you know, maybe beat on somebody, right? It compels action. Whereas when we're content, we're chill, right? It compels chill. So these different emotional reactions, even in the moment, also drive behavior. But the reasoning that we assign to all of our emotions and our morals is coming out of the reason layer. And it's even been posited by pretty serious people that maybe our frontal lobes developed for this purpose. Because you can't really have sociality and people interacting with one another if they can't explain themselves to each other. Why'd you do that? Right? Why'd you do that wrong thing? Well, let me tell you. And maybe I can convince you, right, that I actually did a good thing, not a bad thing, right? And we're going to have this interaction now. Well, how can I have that interaction with you if I don't have that reason layer, if I don't have those frontal lobes doing that work of processing information so I can justify myself to you? And that's a powerful, powerful thing that we have, that skill, that whole skill set that we have. But we do, I will say, that we do lie to ourselves a lot. Because it's not a truth machine. It's a reasoning machine. And I think all of us know, especially in the ex-cult space, how we can reason almost anything into being true to ourselves. But that doesn't make it true, right? But we can reason it out that way. And that's the superpower we have. We can hold two contradictory ideas at the same time, in the same headspace, and make them make sense with each other. We can reconcile impossible things. It's a mental skill we have, but it also is a problem when we don't see that we're doing that. You know, when we come to real wrong-headed conclusions, like L. Ron Hubbard's a great guy and I should listen to him, that, you know, maybe that's not the right conclusion from these facts, right? But we have to reconcile something. This is that whole phenomena of cognitive dissonance that we hear so much about, right? Is you have these ideas and you have to, or these feelings, because the cognitive dissonance goes emotional too. You have to reconcile these conflicting things. That's what the reason layer is doing 24/7. Its sole function is to justify your existence. So we don't always reason out what we're going to do before we do it. We just want something and we go get it. We have a desire for something and we go satisfy that desire, whatever it is. Maybe it's a good thing, maybe it's a bad thing, but we can always reason out why that's necessary and important right now. And if we really need it right now, we can really justify it very, very thoroughly. Again, that's your rationalization reason layer at work. So it's kind of our spokesperson, you could say. Finally, just to summate all of this, now that I've like taken all this time explaining all this, another way of thinking about this might be to compare it to a song. If a song was sort of analogous in that the reason layer is the words of the song, the harmonies and the music are the emotional layer, because emotion, music is the language of emotion, and the moral layer is the beat. It's the thing that's keeping time, right? To bring order to a disordered song, you need a beat. And that's what the moral layer provides, right? So it's kind of, that's my analogy for it. But it's my explanation for why people act the way they do.
Wow, this is really well put together. And I think it's so good that you also show that it's done in these layers, like one is below the other, or one is higher than the other. And there is something about what I've noticed recently, that there are a lot of shows, people have YouTube channels and they show this, or Instagram accounts, or just wherever, where they'll go to rallies. And it can be a Trump rally, but it doesn't matter. Those are just the ones that I've watched. This isn't about politics. Or go to protests on college campuses. And they bring facts with them. And as soon as there is this moment where the person who is shouting something is faced with a fact that sort of breaks down their whole argument, you see almost, I've seen sort of one of two things, maybe even more, but I've noticed this the most, that either they dig their heels in and will then make ad hominem attacks. Well, what's wrong with you? And why are you so stupid that you don't blah, blah, blah. Or it's because you're a this, or you're a woman, or it's just going for whatever they can. Or they'll be done talking, like, because they don't know what to do in that moment when something suddenly, they realize that they've been fed something that has had them pick up, you know, the torch and pitchfork, and it's based in nothing. It's based in lies. And so I wonder, in that moment when we're dealing with really looking at things and dissecting them, what have you noticed happens for people when things are pointed out as not at all based in reality?
Yeah, big time. That's such a great question. And it happens all the time. And it's a source of endless frustration for people who think that facts are going to change minds. And my model explains why they don't. Because the reason layer is the top layer, and that's where facts exist. But emotions and morality are not always based in facts. They're often based in authority or appeals to emotion and appeals to authority. This is simply the way it is. Jesus said it, the thinking is done, right? Like when you're taught that at 4 years old, and then you don't question. Your job is not to question these facts. Your job is to simply comply. And every cult is a compliance culture, right? So to the degree that you're enforcing compliance on people, it gets a little culty, right? And so, but one of the things about compliance is installing facts that must not be questioned or principles or ideas that must not be questioned. And once something enters the moral layer, it's not up for debate. It's not up for question. The thinking is literally done. The thinking's happening at the R layer, at the rationality layer. Thinking's not happening at the moral layer. That's just the rules. That's how it is. This is the way the world is supposed to work. And if you assault somebody's idea of how reality itself works, right? Like try to argue somebody out of their gender. You know, like that's very, very basic to their fundamental structural understanding of themselves. You're not going to talk somebody out of that in 2 minutes. If you could, you'd be dealing with a very, very, very unstable person, right? So the morals are actually what give us stability and give us a sense of structure to the world. And so these are not easily challenged ideas. They are challengeable and we do change them. It's what interventions are all about. But it takes trust. It takes care. It takes empathy. It takes drilling down to that layer. And the only person who can do that is the person. You can't go digging around in their moral layer without their okay. So they're going to have to invite you in. This is where I always go to my thought fortress analogy, which is a little bit of an earlier than the REM model thing, but it's a vital, vital, important point. I think, in fact, you were one of the ones who influenced me thinking this way, was the idea that, you know, somebody establishes a fortress of thought in their mind of the things that must not be questioned, the things that must be true because that's the way my world makes sense to me. You know, whatever it is, L. Ron Hubbard is God or Jesus is Lord or, you know, Krishna is the master of all. Whatever the principles are, they exist deep. And when they're in a thought fortress, you can batter at those walls all day long, but there isn't anything stronger than a prison of belief. Nothing stronger than the mental walls. There's no amount of physical force you can ever bring to bear to change that. The person has to open the door. They have to invite you in. And that's where change is possible, which is why I think a lot of the things we see at rallies, protests, demonstrations, that's when people are in a mode, in a state of, you know, fight. And when you're in fight mode, you are not open and can do, you know, new ideas are not something that's going to be entering the mental sphere, right? You're not there to change your mind. You're there to defend your position. It's the polar opposite of the space you want to create to make change in a person. So you also need to pay attention to factors like that too, right? It's not a matter of having the right zinger or one-liner that's going to somehow bust through their mental armor. Because as you mentioned, what happens is one of two things. And once they run out of answers or rationalizations or reasons to throw back at you as to why their belief is true, and they're just coming up with most of that on the fly, that's not really how they run around thinking about their beliefs. They don't think about their beliefs. That's the whole point. But when forced to justify their beliefs, out will come these words. And if you don't accept them and you keep coming back with more arguments that they then can't counter, well, I don't know what to say, but I'm not changing my belief. This is the truth. And even if I can't justify it to you, I'm not obligated to change it. So I'm not going to. And they'll just walk away. You know? So what you want to do in situations like that is rather than invite that kind of response where they just walls up, you're not getting anywhere and I'm not letting anything in, you try instead, if you can, again, it's always circumstantial, but as best you can, you try to get them to open that door crack. You try to create a friendly, you know, non-hostile, you know, sort of situation where they can let the guard down a little bit and they're no longer in fight mode. And that's the only time you're going to be able to actually maybe make some change. Otherwise, all you're doing, and it's not bad to do this, but all you can do is seed plant, right? Is put the idea out there and hope that maybe, you know, it eventually rolls down to the person's moral layer and they start cogitating on it. But that takes time. It always takes time. When I was in the Sea Org, we had protesters coming to Minnesota. I was out in Minnesota on a project, and we had these anonymous guys running around in the Guy Fawkes masks and with the signs. And one of the signs said, "When was the last time you saw your family?" Right? And I hadn't seen my family in years. And it hit, right? I was like, whoa, that's a good question. But it didn't hit in a way that I was going to consciously think it was hitting. It's only in retrospect that I can look back and see that it hit. At the time, I just looked at it and went, protesters, But there's this little question suddenly in the back of my mind, right? There's the splinter in your mind. How often are you seeing your family, Chris, right? And it just rolls around in there. So sometimes, and it's really important for people to know, sometimes it looks like you're not making any progress when in fact you are, because within 2 years of that happening, I was on the fence. And a year later, I was out of the Sea Org, right? So sometimes it takes time for those seeds to grow. So I don't want people thinking that it's wholly ineffective to try to help somebody in fight mode. But you got to temper your expectations of what you're gonna get.
And I think knowing that you can also just like see that sign and it goes somewhere, and it makes a difference, even though you've been kind of programmed to be against anyone saying anything. There is something even in that, how long has it been since you've seen your family question, that shows a certain level of humanity. Like, right, there is a softness to it that isn't belligerent. It's not in your face. It's, can we look at this for a second? You know, can you notice this? And what is this group that's keeping you away from your family? And I think sometimes that softness is really surprising for people. I told this story and I'll keep it brief because I want to come back to what you want to say. But I told the story on the podcast before about offering someone a cup of tea during an intervention. And that was it. That was the moment. And she realized she hadn't been offered anything. No one had said, here, she had lived with the guru. She attended to the guru. She had had children with the guru. No one helped her with anything. She was in pain. No one cared. She was sick. No one cared. She was still working. She was everything. And, you know, you come with these books and you want to help and you want to teach. And we took a little break. And she was on one side of the room and there was a big table. It was too large for the room, so it was sort of hard to get around it. And there was a tea service on the other side. And I said, hey, while I'm over here, do you want some tea? They don't, it seems they're out of coffee, but I can get you some tea, or would you like some water? And she suddenly stopped dead in her tracks. And she realized no one had asked her what she wanted for years and years and years. No one cared. And so I thought, okay, it's not about the books. It's not, let's just, she's a human being who hasn't been treated as a human being.
There it is, right there, exactly. Humanity will shine through almost 100% of the time over, and again, this is moral layer, emotional layer stuff, right? Connection, community, right? Caring, empathy, feeling like you have existence and that other people acknowledge your existence is half the damn battle, you know, of life, it seems. And And so these are powerful, powerful motivators, powerful, powerful moments that we can create with the smallest of things. This is literally why I had tattooed on my arm, you know, this phrase I heard years ago from Patton Oswalt. It's chaos, be kind. It's like my mantra for life. That's why I tattooed it on myself to remind myself, right? Because sometimes, you know, we in the moment, we can be unkind and it feels like the right thing to do. But I always end up circling back to kindness because it's always the right thing to do. And it's challenging sometimes, especially in the face of opposition. But it is almost the universal solvent, as they say, right? It just like busts through everything.
It does. It does. And you know, I also want to make sure we talk about this idea of moral injury.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because I think that ties in really well with this REM idea that sometimes when people want to have a sense of who they are, they can sometimes get a sense of it by realizing what has been left with them as a moral injury. What they had to engage in doing, or they felt they had to, that they knew at the time, either consciously or subconsciously, was not right. Something didn't feel right. Again, they might not have had the words for it to describe it and all of that, but it just felt off and it didn't ring true with their moral code. And so they're left carrying that. The leaders don't. You know, they're fine with whatever. They've moved on. They don't operate in the past. You know, they don't reflect, you know. Well, so they move forward like a tornado, just plowing through your life, right? Thank you. Thank you very much. But so what do people do with that idea that they recruited people into something that, or then the people might still be there and they left, and those moments that make people really wonder what's, and they ask the question that is this part of the self-gaslighting, what's wrong with me that I, right, that I let this happen or that I engaged in this?
And that is the $1,000 question when in cult recovery, because it's one of the biggest barriers or hurdles or challenges that we face as ex-members of a situation like that. My final chapter in the book is about victims and victimizers. And the fact that all of us held both of those roles in these groups, right? We were not only victimized by the group, but we became victimizers and enablers. We couldn't help ourselves. We thought we were doing the right thing. And that right there, what I just said, is actually the key to unlocking the moral quandary of it, right? Is the self-examination of this is nuanced. It's not day one stuff where you tackle this, I believe. I think this is more advanced stuff because it requires some earlier, that's why I made it the last chapter, right? It's because there's some earlier milestones to hit, like understanding that you have emotional needs or understanding that cults mess with your morality. And this is important. The moral layer is changeable and it does change through your life. You do adopt new rules, ideas as you change. If you move to a new country, everything changes, right? You have to rewrite everything because suddenly you can't drink coffee in a public space where you used to be able to, or whatever, all these crazy new rules and things you have to get used to. So you can go in there and rewrite this stuff. It's not that it's in concrete, and cults will, from day one, start working on manipulating your moral layer. And this is how they get you, because they slowly, through small agreements, little things that don't seem like a big deal at the time, it's Breaking Bad, right? It's every decision made sense in the moment. Every choice you seem to be given seemed to lead obviously in the direction of engaging more and more with the cult's beliefs or ideas or attitudes or morality. And so when they tell you eventually in Scientology after 2 years of being involved in it, well, listen, man, you know, your mom is still giving you a hard time about this. And, you know, I don't know, but it seems to me your mom might not be really with the program here. And maybe she's actually kind of predatory. Maybe there's something actually, like, maybe your mom doesn't really want you to succeed and survive. as much as she pretends to. Maybe there's something going on there, right? You're having this conversation with this ethics officer in a Scientology church about your mom now and whether your mom actually loves you or not. And you're actually entertaining these ideas, whereas 2 years ago when you walked in the front door, you never would have questioned your mother's love for you. It was a part of a stable world for you. This is part of your world picture, right? Your mom loves you. 2 years into the cult, they've worked on you and worked on you and made the cult the senior moral authority. The cult leader is the guy who knows what he's saying more than anybody else. So clearly, when it comes to right and wrong, the cult leader is the person to follow and emulate and listen to, right? And there's all this nodding going on, you know, and all that social pressure to comply and conform and go along with the rules. All of that push is subtly and slowly rewriting your moral layer so that the cult is actually in the senior position to everything else. And it takes time for that to happen. That doesn't happen in 2 days. That happens, say, in a year or two or three or four, right? Where you gradually buy into more and more of the cult's moral authority until they're often in these groups, because of the nature of these groups being as destructive as they are, they often create their own trouble, and they will do so by creating moral dilemmas. They will demand suddenly too much. Maybe you didn't buy in as far as you were supposed to, or as much as they thought you were, or there's some particular thing you never quite bought into. You bought into all this other stuff, but this one thing, I don't know about that. I'll give you an example. It was me and my mom in Scientology. My mom left Scientology quietly while I was still in. And I maintained communication with her. And it wasn't, I was always trying to get her back in. And I was never not doing that. But I was okay with talking to my mom because she's my mom, right? And I was never going to let anything get in the way of that. But the church really, really tried to do that number of, well, I don't know about this lady. I think maybe you shouldn't be talking to her. I think maybe we should, you know, do a disconnection here. And I resisted and resisted that because it wasn't really aligned with my morality to disconnect from my mom, right? And the more they pushed on it, the more it became a bit of a problem. Whereas for a lot of people in that group, the second the cult said, you know, you got to disconnect from your mom, they were like, okay. That wasn't a problem. So I had a little bit of a moral exception on that point where other people maybe didn't, right? Just because of the nature of my relationship with my mom all those years. So for me, that was something I never really gave in on. And when the cult pushed me on it, it became a moral dilemma. And I would sort of experience the cognitive dissonance of that because, you know, my mom is important to me. My Scientology is important to me. What do I do here? And I would sort of figure out a way to navigate and say the right words to stave off the ethics people so I could maintain this line. But I watched lots of other people who did not, you know, hold that ground because they had already ceded moral authority to Scientology. And whatever Scientology told them to do, you know, that's what they were going to do. And believe me, there were plenty of things in my life I ceded moral, I gave over, in other words, right, my moral authority to Scientology and did things I absolutely should not have done. You know, I'm not going to enumerate all my crimes right now, but, you know, there were some bad things that I did when I was in Scientology as far as how I treated other people. And I did it because I thought it was the right thing to do. And in my own recovery and in working with other people, again, in a non-therapeutic way, right? I don't offer therapy to people, but I do work with them. This is one of the questions we tackle. We talk about this is, okay, so if you're experiencing post-cult guilt, well, one way to deal with that or think about that or look at that is, well, what was your mindset then? And what was your moral mindset then? And what is it now? If it was wrong then and you knew it was wrong then and you did it anyway, well, that's one thing. If you thought this was actually the right thing to do and disconnecting from your mom or, you know, committing credit card fraud or, you know, telling off this person or ripping their face or, you know, throwing them into a, you know, a locked room for 24 hours or whatever it was you did to somebody, If you believed you were doing that for their good, I'm sorry, but I think of that as a different context than I knew I was hurting them and I reveled in it. I think those are two different mindsets. And I think that the guilt that one could connect, you know, is different from one to the next. If you're a well-intentioned person and you were manipulated into believing hurting people was helping them, so congratulations, you were lied to successfully, just like all of us were. That doesn't make you an evil person. It makes you a normal person, right? It makes you somebody who invests trust in people and believes them and is actually a really normal human being. So reconciling that is sort of reviewing or looking and taking a real hard, objective, blunt look at your own intentions for yourself and for other people, and then working out in therapy or working out in life what I did, what I'm doing now, and how do these things align, or do they, or how can I reconcile this, you know? And I think it's going to be, I think that's why it's so highly individual for each person, because we all, I think all of us have a little bit of a journey in looking at, well, what did I want when I was abusing that person, right? And why did I do those things, right? And I think REM gives you an ability to, you know, kind of break it down into these layers and kind of look at it that way. But at the end of the day, we do have to find our own answers as to what we intend toward other people and how we reconcile whatever guilt is sitting there from those intentions.
Well said. And I guess I want to caution people to not feel that they're not deserving of a good life and a happy life just because they did things with good intentions at the time, or pure intentions, or just because they didn't know to ask, or they couldn't ask if this was healthy or not or safe or not. But that they still get to have a life that is a good one, a happy one, a healthy one, even still.
Absolutely. Oh, everybody deserves that. Nobody... Here's another thing to consider in all of this, right? And I say this a number of times in the book because I want to drive it home to folks, especially when they just get out and they're just like, I mean, so many things are so confusing. I was a mess when I first got, I mean, I didn't know up from down, you know, it was a very confusing place to be. And so I think some very early on stable things to hold on to is most of us are well-intentioned people. Statistically speaking, we know this is a fact. Most of us are not psychopaths. Most of us are not disordered people. So most of us can lean on that a little bit, some of those statistics a little bit, even in our darkest moments, and go, well, okay, I was manipulated in a system to do things that I would never normally have done. Zimbardo wrote a whole book about this. This is called the Lucifer Effect. It's the situation that creates circumstances that channel you into doing things that you would never have normally done. That's another way of thinking about this situation. So if you wouldn't normally have done it, then maybe ease off a little bit in the guilt about it. Sure, take whatever degree of responsibility now that you can for making up for what you did, if that's possible. If you can reach back and apologize to some people or reconcile some relationships or sort out some situations or pay back some money or whatever it is, go for it. But I tell people, you know, but don't kill yourself about that, because you still have the rest of your life to live, and what you do tomorrow matters a hell of a lot more than what you did yesterday, you know, and you have the opportunity tomorrow to do better than you did yesterday. And if that's your intent and what's driving you through life, you're good. You're gold. It's the people who don't want to do better the next day. It's the people who don't care about anybody else that have a problem. And most of them aren't looking to us for help in their post-cult life, you know? So, you know, the psychopaths don't want therapy or help. And sometimes psychopaths get into cults, right? And when they pop out, they can be horrible people. But if you're feeling all guilty and torn up about yourself, that kind of means you're a good person. So maybe ease off a little bit on the self-flagellation, you know? And I say this out of so many hours of experience, you know, as, you know, beating up on myself. So the system thing is a kind of important thing to understand about this. Our choices were being robbed from us. They were being systematically taken away from us. And whether we acknowledge that in the moment or not, very rarely when we're in the cult do we see that happening, but it was happening. And so you can also give yourself a little peace of mind in the here and now that a lot of the things you did in the cult, you did because you literally had no other choice.
You know, I will sometimes say to people, when you had no other choice but to do something that you realize now is wrong, however you define wrong, but let's say that feels like it's not aligned with your ethics, you want to look at the system and how it put you into that situation and how it's not guided by right or wrong. It's sort of the playground of the leader. And you are, you know, feeding their ego and, you know, playing out their fantasies, I think. So it's not at all, it's not about you. It's about what you were stuck in, what you were trapped in. And people will sometimes notice, and or I'll encourage them to notice, given the freedom to make other decisions, what decisions do they make? And right now that they can, that's when you learn a lot more about yourself and also what freedoms you were not afforded in the past that have left you feeling bad, which is so unfortunate. So I know we're about done with our time talking, which is sad.
Well, we're going to have to do this again soon because I need to get you on my show too. Because
I just
don't have enough Rachel in my life. So.
Oh, that's very sweet. Okay, yes, anytime. You just tell me when. But I want people to know about the book, where to find it, and other work that you're doing, and also Scientology A to Xeno. I want to make sure people also pick that up because it's like a... it's a textbook about Scientology, which is very cool. So go ahead, tell people where to find you and all your wonderful.
Absolutely. You can find me on YouTube under Chris Shelton, MSC. Yes, I am showing off with those letters after my name. And so that's my channel name, Chris Shelton, MSC. And you can also, of course, find my website, chrissheltonmsc.org. I have some written articles, a little bit of a blog there and a little bit about me. But my channel is basically where my work is. And of course, you can find my books, Scientology A to Xenu or What Now? Practical Guide for Life After a Cult. Both of them self-published on Amazon. And I am currently in the middle of recording the audiobook version of What Now? I have an audiobook version for Scientology A to Xenu. That's also up on Audible and Amazon. And of course, with What Now, it's also available through Ingram Spark. So if you want to walk down to your local bookstore and ask them to order it for you, they can actually order it through Ingram Spark and get it that way too. You don't have to go through Amazon to get my book.
Wow. Okay. Oh, that's good to know. And what is it called again?
Ingram Spark.
Ingram Spark. Okay.
Ingram Spark. But all you have to do is go to your Barnes & Noble or local bookstore and just say, hey, can you look up this book and order it for me? And they'll be able to do it. Through that. That's just a standard kind of book ordering sort of thing as I was understanding it.
So. Yeah, that's very cool. Okay, good. Always a delight to talk to you. And congratulations on your new book and the REM model and how it makes it understandable on so many levels when people are trying to understand what happened and how it happened. And so then also the fact that your book moves people forward into the future, what they can do now. So you're kind of taking care of the different time zones, right?
That's right. It's very forward thinking. That's right. And the last thing I want to say here today is you are the one in charge of your recovery, right? I'm going to assume a lot of people listening today, right, are recovering. And it really is up to you. There isn't anybody else who can grab the horns and sort of steer your recovery. It's your journey. So I really feel there's a lot of empowerment possible in just kind of owning that and taking it on, right? It's like, if the therapy isn't working, get another therapist. If this isn't working out, take charge, do something different, right? Find out more. Learning is always where it's at. For me, this has been the formula for success and recovery. And I really hope it can be for other people too.
One more thing before you go. Thank you to Chris for coming back on the show. Always good to talk to him. And it's exciting about his new book and his new model. And something that I want to explore that Chris and I talked about was this idea that you come up with rationalizations for your own abuse. Yeah, we do that. We think there must be a reason. The human brain wants us to find reasons, wants us to be able to answer the why questions and the how questions. It wants us to be able to have some explanation, because for a lot of people and for most people, it's calming to know why and to have a reason. The problem becomes with the word that Chris used, the rationalization. We will rationalize the fact that somehow we are at fault. And it's important to understand why we do this. Sometimes we've learned that there's something inherently wrong with us. And we sometimes learn that in abusive households, and we sometimes learn that in abusive relationships, and we sometimes learn that in cultic systems and religious systems, the idea of original sin, that there is something in us that we have to somehow keep on top of or keep fighting against, because it will drive our behaviors and we will do things that are wrong. We will do things that we shouldn't do. And so we are used to having a default switch, where we say, what did I do to cause this? What did I do to create this scene? What did I do to make this person abuse me? Or the word abuse might not even be used, because you might not think that that's what's happening to you. It might instead be in your head something like, what did I do to make this person have to teach me a lesson about my bad behavior? And so I wonder if there is a way to start looking at this differently. If you can see that you might be thinking about what you did in order to have some answer, but that it isn't necessarily the answer. Believe it or not, as much as this sort of self-flagellation can be painful when you just are beating yourself up for what you are sure you did wrong, or what you are sure you did that caused this bad thing to happen to you, or this uncomfortable or this even painful and abusive thing to happen to you, it's sometimes even more uncomfortable to think, have I chosen an organization that would actually indiscriminately harm me, that would actually, without sensitivity, cause me pain just because it can, just because it wants to? Have I chosen to marry someone or live with someone, work for someone, connect with anyone who actually doesn't have the same ethical standards, the same moral code that I do, and doesn't mind hurting other people and doesn't mind mistreating me or abusing me, no matter how kind and wonderful and sacrificial and giving I've been to them? For some people, it's actually easier to think, what have I done, than to think, who have I chosen? And what have I chosen to be a part of? Who out there can I not trust anymore, who I thought I could trust? What religious organization out there is actually abusing their power over people?
For some people, that is easier because they'd rather it be outside of themselves. But for others, that is so much harder to swallow, so much harder to take on, because it shifts your whole worldview. And it makes you also think, do I need to be out of this group? Do I need to be out of this relationship? And sometimes by the time you notice what's wrong, you've already become deeply embedded in that relationship or in that group, or deeply dependent on that person or on that group. But just know there are sometimes that you will accept that rationalization to make it easier in the moment, but it just could be false. And it could be that you're putting too much on yourself as blame just because it's too painful to really notice what's happening, and that someone out there or an organization out there is harming you in a way that you don't deserve and no one deserves. It's good to have clear vision, but I also can relate to the fact that it is hard to see it for what it is sometimes. Thank you again to Chris for his years, actually, of contributions and insights. And I will talk to you all next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.